This year.
I'm going to call the meeting to order of the Commerce Committee. We do have a quorum. Our first item of business is approval of our minutes from our last meeting, which was March 13th, 2024. Representative Katisa Batun.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of the March 13th.
Representative Katisa Batun moves approval of our minutes from March 13th, 2024. Any discussion to the motion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Next, before we get to our first bill, we do have one thing to take care of from last week. Last week we heard House File 3320 from Representative Kraft. We had the motion to send that bill to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. It turns out that they don't need to see that bill, so we're going to alter the motion so it goes to the Environment Committee, and that requires two motions, which I will make. First, I will move to reconsider our motion to re-refer House File 3320 to Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Next, I will move that House File 3320 be re-referred, be recommended re-referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3320 is recommended to be referred to the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee. Our first bill on the agenda today is House File 4100 from Representative Ryer. We have previously heard this bill in committee, so we will not be taking testimony today, but we will be taking up an amendment. So I will move House File 4100 be re-referred to Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. I'll further move the DE3 amendment, and I will further move the A2 amendment to the DE3 amendment. So I think what we should do here is have Representative Ryer describe the A2 amendment. We can adopt that, and then we can discuss the DE in its entirety and move from there. So why don't you, to the A2 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. The A2 amendment makes some minor changes to wording in the bill. It has a couple of things that it clarifies. It adds specifically that medical debt charged to a credit card is credit card debt, not medical debt, for management within the financial system to avoid the complexity that would go with trying to parse out medical from other purposes on a credit card. We also add that a protection for creditors, that bona fide errors are recognized and they're protected from that, and that adding some language around a clearer communication in the section that is about updating the forms.
Great. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A2 amendment to the DE3 amendment is adopted. Now, Representative Ryer, I think what we'll do next is have you describe the DE3 amendment. We'll vote to adopt the DE3 amendment, and then we'll have discussion on the bill and vote on the bill. So, Representative Ryer, to the DE3 amendment.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. So we make a variety of changes to the bill that you saw just some days ago, a week and a half ago or so. I just want to remind you, though, that we're here because of the damage that medical debt does and consumer debt can do to people, harming their overall financial well-being with an equity impact on people of color, especially black people and people with disabilities. It limits access to care. 59% of people with medical debt don't get care because of cost, compared to 17% of people without. And a study that was published this month found that people with medical debt have more days of poor physical and mental health, more years of life lost, and higher mortality rates for both all cause and leading causes of death. And these researchers say, quote, "Our findings reinforce medical debt as a social determinant of health," end quote. So with that, I will also remind you that the goal of this bill is to make it possible for people to afford their lives, as well as for businesses to do well. And so we're seeking that balance. In the changes in the DE3, medical debt, we clarify in statute, as I mentioned, that medical debt charged to a credit card is treated as credit card debt. We added a definition of medical necessity that's consistent with the CMS version used for Medicare. We removed the provision related to the copay accumulator in the House version, and we're continuing to work on the proper balance of use of credit scores and interest on medical debt as tools to allow providers to collect debt. We focused the consumer protection provisions. You'll recall that's the second of the major sections of the bill, and it's focused more closely on medical debt. So now patients will be allowed to successfully defend against a wrongful lawsuit for medical debt to request payment for their costs and fees. They'll have protections like a person would have for other types of debt. For example, protections against using false and misleading statements to collect debt or using threats of illegal activity to compel medical debt. And both patients and themselves and the Attorney General would have the ability to enforce those. As I mentioned, we added protections for creditors against bona fide errors, and we removed provisions related to some of the other broader consumer protection bills or changes. We made a number of changes from what you saw before in garnishment. We tweaked language about property people can keep from what we had proposed to now, but we kept the focus on modernizing the language. And we're still working on the details of a small bankruptcy wildcard exemption. It's something most Minnesotans already get through federal bankruptcy exemptions. For wage garnishment, we added a new feature that creates a tiered garnishment process based on income. I think this is a really thoughtful proposal, and it was made by a member of the Minnesota Creditors Rights Association. So currently in law, anyone with an income of about $23,000 a year is exempt from garnishment, and everyone else is subject to garnishment at 25% of their income. This bill proposes to create two intermediate steps where people just above minimum wage could be garnished for 5% of their income. People just over that level could be garnished at 15, and then people above about the median single income and over would be subject to the current 25%. And then finally, again, for garnishment, we changed the proposed balance that would be protected in a person's bank account. Currently at zero, we proposed 5,000. We've adjusted it down to 4,000. We're seeking a balance between legal judgment collection and people's ability to pay for the basics like rent and groceries. The conversations are continuing. We have been meeting multiple times a week, hours at a time, making progress each time. And so I appreciate your consideration to pass the DE3 amendment and then further to pass this and move it forward to the next committee. Thank you.
All right. So what I'd like to do is vote on the DE3 amendment and then have discussion. So if people have questions about what's in the DE3 amendment, now would be a good time to ask. But if you have further comments or discussion, let's get the amendment on. Any discussion to the DE3 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The DE3 amendment, as amended, is adopted. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Ryer, thank you. This bill does look better than it left our, or I should say when we laid the bill over in committee. Members, I just want to remind you of a couple of things. It's a tough world out there that we live in, and that tough world is people need services, people need to buy products, people need to get medical attention, and we fully respect and understand that. On the other side of the equation, unpaid debt and unpaid medical bills don't automatically just get discharged and go away from the standpoint that there have been employees who have been paid wages to provide those services and medical supplies and what have you to administer that care. And what happens is a clinic or a doctor's office that ends up or a business that ends up having to charge off that debt ends up having to roll that back into their pricing, or we're not able to see other patients or just to service other customers. It's a balance that we need to strike, and I don't know that we've actually got that balance in this bill yet. Again, it's vastly improved, and I appreciate your work on it, Representative Ryer. But I also think that it just doesn't anticipate the next chapter in the book about where we would be. And I mentioned this in committee earlier, and I'll mention it again. This committee has heard questions and issues about Fairview, their viability, and what's going to happen to them and where we're going. And there's negotiations that are ongoing right now. And Fairview could end up closing its doors. And who would be the next Fairview if we end up having a lot of unpaid debt that is out there, uncollectible debt? And so I'm just trying to find a balance for all people who need medical care, including those who may not have the resources to pay for them and the like. So I'm going to recommend a no vote at this point for the bill as we're going to be looking at passing it out of committee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cadiz Watoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ryer, I just wanted to make a quick comment on the change of like to the sliding scale of garnishments. I think that that is a really good step in the right direction, meeting folks where they are and making it a little bit easier for folks who are not earning quite as much to still maintain their earnings but contribute as they go. Thank you.
Brief closing comments, Representative Ryer.
Thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be able to move this forward, and discussions will continue. Representative Driscoll, I'd be happy to sit down and go through it. I'd just love to hear the details on what you're thinking. Thank you.
All right. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4100, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Oh.
No.
The motion does prevail, and House File 4100, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. Thank you, Representative Ryer. The next item on our agenda is House File 3692 from Chair Hassan. As Chair Hassan walks up, I will move House File 3692 be laid over for possible inclusion. I will also move the A2 amendment, which I presume gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Any discussion to the A2? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A2 is adopted. Chair Hassan, to your bill.
And Mr. Chair, we need to make an oral amendment to the A2 as well.
What oral amendment are you looking at here?
And Mr. Elwood will explain that.
And we are laying the bill over today, so it'd be good to describe the oral amendment, but we may not need to actually act on it. But what's the amendment you're looking for?
Mr. Chair and members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, and on the 3692 and the amendment, there's a technical amendment that was it's probably to the bill and not to the amendment. Actually, I mean not to the A2 on line 21.21. I'm sorry. Too many bills. It's on line 21-22, and it after the word terminates, insert under section 559.21. It's a very technical amendment.
Okay. I think, Chair Hassan, that I would be inclined to deal with that in the next stage of the bill and not take on that today, since it makes a cross-reference and members may not know what that cross-reference is. I'd rather do that at a different time. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, since it is being laid over and we'll have to take action potentially on this bill, I am not opposed if you want to bring that amendment back at the time that this committee brings that back up, just because if it's within our jurisdiction, it's nice to keep business where business should be conducted.
All right, Chair Hassan, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Today we have House File 3692, which is a bill to reform Minnesota residential contract for deed laws. We want to make sure that there's a better balance of the interest between investor, seller, and buyers of homes on contract for deed. And then, two, we want to increase protections for residential contract for deed. As you guys know, contract for deed is a tool for folks to use sometimes the dream of owning a home. When it's used correctly, it's a wonderful tool. But lately we've been hearing, deceits and deceptions about folks drawing up contracts that people don't understand, hefty down payments, balloon payments that are not explained well, and families are being left out with penniless and homeless with eviction on their record. This is not one incident or two incidents. It's a problem that has been happening. I want to thank Ron Elwood and the folks in the Legal Aid team for assembling all stakeholders and working on this almost all summer and all the whole interim and figuring out The amendment that we just adopted addresses one problem that was, it was, we were all in agreement 90%, and that amendment addresses the one outstanding issue. This is a good bill. It was consulted with many different groups, Minnesota Attorney General, Minnesota Department of Commerce, Minnesota Council on Latina Affairs, Minnesota Homeownership Center, SACAN Community Resource, Habitat for Humanity, Neighborhood Development Alliance, Exodus Lending, ISURON, and then the stakeholders that have given their feedback on this is Minnesota Bar Association, the Real Property Section, Minnesota Realtors, Minnesota Land Title Association, Minnesota Mortgage Association, Minnesota Bankers Association, Minnesota Credit Union Association. We consulted with everyone who has a stake and skin on this game, and the bill in front of you is the agreement that says we're going to create real protections for buyers, and this is only on the residential. It doesn't impact the commercial section of contract for deed. And in my opinion, it's a great bill. It's a bill that I can say will create extra protections for buyers and will balance the scale for both buyers and sellers, investor sellers. With that, I have Mr. Ron Elwood, who either will testify or stand for questions, whichever one. But it's a good bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Hassan. Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I really want to thank Representative Hassan for her work on this bill. This is a really important bill, and I'll just highlight a couple of things that it really does that's going to make the scales more balanced between buyers and sellers and protect buyers. First of all, I want to be clear, it protects the mom and pop sales. It does not affect in any way sales between a parent to a child or between family members or a long time renter purchasing a home from a landlord. Those kinds of individual transactions are unaffected by the bill. This deals with the phenomenon, and in some cases a negative phenomenon, of speculators and investor sellers taking advantage of unsophisticated buyers. So, and the provisions that protect those folks have to do with enhanced and improved and extremely important disclosures about what people are getting into, that there is a balloon payment, and what their responsibilities are. It protects against flipping, where you take a big down payment, people make a couple of payments, they can't make it, they get kicked out within 90 days, and they do it again and over and over and over again. So this churning and flipping is protected, and it protects heirs. As many of you know, there's always a due on sale clause. Excuse me. There's always a due on sale clause in a mortgage, which is the seller has a mortgage on the home and then sells the home for on contract for deed. So it would say that on a transfer, then the lender can call the loan. And of course, there's a federal law that protects heirs and divorcees and people sending or putting the house into a trust. This bill, but that federal law doesn't protect contracts for deed and protect heirs in those transactions. This bill will do that. So with that, I just want to urge your support, and finally just want to really thank especially the Minnesota Association of Realtors, Paul Egger, and his folks that worked with us extensively to get to where we are. This amendment was a product of a lot of discussion with him and the Real Property Section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, and we really can't thank them enough for their collaboration to get where we are. Thank you very much. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, discussion to the bill. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Elwood. Not a lot of people know this, but you and I do, how we spent our Friday afternoon last week. I want to tell you that Mr. Elwood has been very gracious with his time on this bill and the questions that I have raised. And again, just for backgrounding for the committee, I have professional training and experience in many of the topics that come before this committee. I think that's one of the reasons why I was asked to be on this committee by my caucus. And one of the areas that I do not stand for and tolerate is what is called predatory lending. And we've had predatory lending that occurred at several different times during the course of U.S. history. And there's no place for predatory lending. There is a place for people who qualify for financing, who have the ability to pay for that, regardless of your protected classifications, et cetera, under federal and state law. I also like the fact that we are moving toward this with contract for deeds, and we're leaving the private transaction between a property owner individual to selling to another property buyer individual. I understand the need for a bill and regulation that would reduce or eliminate predatory lending practices by some, not all. And we would not have to have state statutes as fat and as big as they are if the other 2% of the population would just play along well with the rest of us. And our problem is that doesn't happen, and that's why we have state laws. There are some minor changes in here that affect the mom-and-pop sale. I'm still trying to work on an acceptance of this, just kind of processing through different kinds of activities that may happen. So I want to let you know that I appreciate where we're at, and I appreciate the time that you gave me to answer questions. You and I have worked on other legislation in the past and have been successful on that, and I think we can get to a spot. But I just don't have a comfort level right now here today. I need some more time to kind of digest it, so I'm glad that the chair is laying the bill over and some more time to kind of just digest this a little bit. So, again, thank you, Mr. Elwood. That does not mean that that's a guaranteed yes coming up, but I do like the work that we've done, and thanks to you, Representative Hassan, for your work so far on this bill as well.
Any closing comments, Chair Hassan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to share this stats with you. Nearly three-quarters of Americans say owning a home is higher measure of achievement than a successful career, raising a family, or earning a college degree. I want to make sure that that dream comes true for many of our families in our communities. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you, Chair Hassan. And I recently spoke to someone in my district who's been impacted by a contract for deed situation. So I appreciate your work on the bill. And with that, the bill is laid over. The next item on our agenda today is House File 1930 from Representative Freiberg. Before we take the bill up, I do want, I see there's a number of people in the audience who are here for this bill. That does not surprise me in the least. I know that this is a bill that generates a lot of strong views, and I have complete respect for those views. I want everyone in the audience to be clear, though. The reason why this bill comes before this committee is because of a very small provision in it compared to the rest of the bill that has to deal with how certain insurance products relate to this policy. The jurisdiction of this committee only extends to that provision. So that's all we're going to talk about, aside from maybe a brief overview of the bill from the author. But in terms of testimony, member discussion today, we're going to stay focused on the jurisdiction of the bill. I understand the bill's gone through multiple other committee stops where the other issues have been discussed and addressed. We're not going to do that here today. We're going to stay focused on the insurance part of the bill, which is Article 1, Section 2, and Article 2, Article 1, Section 11, and Article 2, Section 1. Those are the sections of the bill that we're discussing today. So, Chair Freiberg, do you want to move your bill?
Yes, I will move House File 1930 to be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee.
Chair Freiberg moves House File 1930 be re-referred to Committee on Ways and Means, and then you have the A-15 Amendment. I assume you want to move that.
Correct.
Chair Freiberg moves the A-15 Amendment, which gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it. Any discussion to the amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A-15 is adopted. Chair Freiberg, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that explanation as well. The Minnesota End of Life Option Act is modeled after an Oregon law which has been in effect since 1997. 10 states in the District of Columbia have enacted similar laws since that time. And I know we are discussing the provisions germane to the Commerce Committee, but you mentioned a brief overview just so we're aware of what we're discussing for what's in the bill. And I'll just give you a sense for the main criteria, which have remained unchanged since I first introduced the bill in 2015. So to qualify for medical, the bill would authorize medical aid in dying, and to qualify for that process, a person must be an adult, meaning they're 18 or over. They have to be diagnosed with a terminal illness with a prognosis of 6 months or less to live. They have to have the mental capacity to make healthcare decisions and provide informed consent, so people with dementia don't qualify. They have to have the ability to self-administer the medication, so injections or infusions are prohibited. two providers have to evaluate the patient and agree that they meet the qualifications. And both of those providers have to confirm that the patient is acting of their own volition and not subject to coercion. They have to inform the patient of all feasible end-of-life care options, including hospice and symptom management, and they have to provide a referral to hospice if indicated. They have to offer the patient the opportunity to rescind the request at any time. So with that out of the way, I'll speak to the provisions germane to this committee. And I've run these provisions by the Commerce Department, and they are okay with the language. They think it is workable. So Article 1, Section 11 says that insurance policies can't be affected by someone making or rescinding a request for medical aid in dying. Similarly, insurers can't deny benefits based on the availability of medical aid in dying. Article 2, Section 1 says that insurance exclusions that would apply if a person dies by suicide don't apply when somebody dies because of medical aid in dying. Those are the two provisions in their entirety. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers.
All right, we will now take testimony. And as one final reminder, testimony needs to be to the two provisions you just heard Chair Freiberg describe. The first testifier on the list is Thaddeus Pope. And as a reminder, testimony needs to be limited to 2 minutes per person. Mr. Pope, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Chair Stevenson, members of the committee. My name is Thaddeus Pope. I'm a law professor at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law in St. Paul, and I've written over 300 articles and 2 books on end-of-life health care decision-making, and I speak in favor of the bill. The two sections, Article 1, Section 11, and Article 2, Section 1, address the relationship of this health care option to life and health insurance. And they provide that that insurance policies cannot be conditioned upon or affected by the use or the non-use of medical aid in dying. These two sections are standard and widely used. First, they're common in the MAID statutes of 10 other states that have already authorized medical aid in dying. Second, they're common in more than 20 bills that are being considered right now by other state legislatures. And third, these sections parallel those in the 1993 Minnesota Statute 145C. That statute addresses health care decisions and advance directives, and like the bill before you, it addresses actions taken by health care professionals that end a patient's life at their request. And it makes good sense to have parallel provisions in both statutes. Like HF 1930, 145C12 prohibits insurance policies from being affected by an individual's healthcare treatment choices. Minnesota patients use 145C every day. When terminally or seriously ill, patients withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment, and that causes their death. 145C prohibits health and life insurers from considering such choices in whether or how to write insurance policy. HF 1930 similarly prohibits health and life insurers from considering patients' choices for MAID. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Ellen Kennedy. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and proceed to your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Ellen Kennedy, Executive Director of World Without Genocide and an adjunct professor at Mitchell Hamlin School of Law. And I come in a personal capacity, but I will speak to the issue. My husband's dying request of me was to ask for support of this bill. This proposed legislation provides important insurance protections for patients and for their families. It keeps insurance policies as they were originally established by the insurance provider before a person may have opted for a medical aid in dying request, and I will highlight 4 points. First, policies and rates for life, health, or accident policies cannot be affected by someone making or rescinding a request for medical aid in dying. Second, policies cannot be invalidated on that basis. Third, benefits cannot be denied or altered to a person because of requesting medical aid in dying. Fourth, benefit payments cannot be excluded on the basis of suicide, because medical aid in dying is not suicide. Insurance policies issued in the state of Minnesota can exclude benefit payments for persons who die of suicide within 1 year from the issuance of their policy. This act is very clear. Persons who self-administer medication in compliance with the strict requirements and protections for medical aid in dying are not dying of suicide. Therefore, benefit payments cannot be excluded. This bill safeguards the insurance policies of families and patients who seek to use this option. And I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Michael Tedford. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome to the committee. And following Mr. Tedford will be Brian Fleming. So, Mr. Fleming, if you want to come down so you're close by when Mr. Tedford is done, that'd be helpful. Mr. Tedford.
I'm Mike Tedford. Committee Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, thank you for hearing my testimony on the insurance provisions in House File 1913. As a surgeon for nearly 40 years, I have accompanied my patients with head and neck cancers from diagnosis to cure or through every step to death. I took an oath to do no harm and to be an advocate for my patients. My role as healer at the end of a life is to provide comfort and care, respect patients' values, and respond to their needs. This includes supporting their decision to utilize medical aid in dying and to minimize the suffering at end of life, which is primarily pain, but for my patients includes disabling and disfiguring surgery, ongoing bleeding and weepage of body fluids from tumors extending through the neck, airway compromise with air hunger and asphyxiation.
And Dr. Tedford, I have to ask you to bring your testimony to the insurance issues. I think you're talking about other parts of the bill right now.
My patients turn to me with every question you can imagine about their care. What does my insurance cover? Why is the insurance company denying the care you recommend? That care includes imaging, medication prescriptions, diagnostic procedures, and surgery. Given the challenges we all face with dealing with insurance companies, I'm glad to report that never has any representative of any insurance company, Medicare, Medicaid, Minnesota Care, denied care simply because the patient had been admitted to hospice, comfort care, or any other end-of-life alternative. Section 11 explicitly underscores that this same standard applies to the availability of medical aid in dying. Your colleagues have taken into account our patients' questions and concerns with the carefully crafted language and sections you are focused on today. The simple and very clear language is easy for all to understand and can be used by clinicians to reassure our patients and by patients in the back and forth with their insurance companies, including life insurance companies. Please pass this bill this year. Minnesotans are living and dying every day. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Brian Fleming, who will be followed by Dr. Peter Daly. Mr. Fleming, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Brian Fleming. I am the president of the National Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors, Minnesota Chapter. We do not take any position as financial advisors on physician-assisted suicide in general. That is up to the legislature. Life insurance policies have suicide exclusions, usually for the first year, because these policies are designed to cover unanticipated future events. During the exclusion period, if a client dies by suicide, the company will return the premiums paid but not pay out the death benefit. After the exclusionary period, they will pay out the death benefit. The reason for the exclusion period is that a client will not have a financial incentive to buy a policy with the intention of committing suicide. The language in this bill not only prohibits an insurance company from underwriting around the applicant's intent or history in this area, but also voids the suicide exclusion for physician-assisted suicide, which in fact gives anyone contemplating this a financial incentive to buy a policy. I don't ever want to have a client buy a life insurance policy and then commit suicide the following week. These provisions are likely to make coverage more difficult for some to purchase and more expensive for all Minnesotans. Life insurance companies need to accurately assess the potential risk for each client. So, for example, I need to ask a client if they skydive or if they have a dangerous job. This is so all clients can pay a rate that is reasonable for the risk. If this bill puts limitations on what rates a life insurer can charge, that could force some providers out of the marketplace, especially for burial or smaller policies. We also want to maintain a robust marketplace. We don't feel this language is necessary or helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Dr. Peter Daly, who will be followed by Kathy Blazer. Dr. Daly, come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Dr. Peter Daly. I've been a practicing Minnesota surgeon for 33 years. I oppose this legislation for many reasons, but I wish to address here how Article 1, Section 11 is not a sufficient safeguard to prevent abuse and denial of coverage by health insurance companies. First, the statutory language is open-ended, and terms such as coercion are not defined. Second, there is an obvious financial incentive for health insurance to propose a less expensive course of death, which is an unavoidable conflict of interest. Third, there are no penalties or compliance mechanisms written into the statute to monitor or compel enforcement. Let me explain. The business model of health insurers is built on maximizing premiums and minimizing claims. I see coverage denied every day in my practice. Treatments are often categorized as experimental or by design, denied to see who will fight back. You apply this to expensive cancer and organ failure costs, and the only reason health insurance companies will ultimately comply is if they have to. There needs to be penalties. Regarding coercion and conflict of interest, health care is expensive and death is cheap. If this bill passes, patients and families will be worn down by a system that subtly coerces them into giving up, or short of assisted suicide will push them into less costly treatment options. In the context of patients with chronic illness, severe illness, or disability, where their patient is diagnosed as terminal under this particular statute for purposes of obtaining lethal drugs will not prevent insurance companies from offering less effective treatment options more generally for those conditions, knowing that medical aid in dying will be available at some point and that all doctors under this bill must counsel it as a treatment option, which is its own form of coercion. I myself was a patient in 2021. I personally received a diagnosis of wildly metastatic incurable cancer. Average survival 2 years. I had a bone marrow transplant and I have ongoing chemotherapy. Had assisted suicide been available, I may not have received coverage for my treatments, but here I am in front of you in real life. You really can't predict the future as tidy and cleanly as this bill suggests. Lack of abuse safeguards, coercion, imprecise prognoses in real life, these are the problems with this legislation. Protecting the choices of those who want assisted suicide will endanger healthcare access for everyone. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next testifier is Kathy Blazer, who will be followed by Robert Tibisar. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Chair and members. Kathy Blazer, Co-Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. Insurance companies have across our nation denied life-preserving treatments and approved assisted suicide drugs for patients that they deem a poor investment for life-saving treatment. Those with a lower perceived quality of life have borne the brunt of coercion through insurance denial of care and instead received insurance approval of assisted suicide drugs, a far cheaper option than the treatments and supports they actually sought. Dr. T. Brian Callister, a clinician and professor of medicine in Nevada, has previously shared his testimony against Minnesota's assisted suicide bill. He tells of two patients, one in California and one in Oregon, who had cancer diagnoses that could be treated well with what in Nevada was standard medical care. Instead, in his conversations with their California and Oregon insurance companies, where assisted suicide is readily offered, both patients received denials from the insurance of his recommended treatment, and instead he was encouraged to offer them assisted suicide, legal in their states, but not in Nevada. Nevada's health care would have potentially saved their lives. The California and Oregon insurers had no interest in doing that. There are too many instances of people having to fight their insurer for needed treatments. Adding assisted suicide as an option will only exacerbate this problem. In Oregon, the one consistent area of declining healthcare spending is long-term care, which has decreased by up to 20% year over year from 2019 to 2021. Over the same period of time, Oregonians succumbing to assisted suicide have increased by almost 60%. You don't need long-term care if you have been assisted in your suicide. Having recently gone through end-of-life decisions with my own mother, if this bill had been in place over her last 8 weeks of life, she would have had 14 mandated offers of assisted suicide during treatment discussions with her cardiologist, nephrologist, rheumatologist, and internist. Six of those over 3 days in back-to-back appointments with different doctors for different diagnoses. That is the very definition of coercion. Please vote no.
Our next testifier is Robert Tibisar. Please come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Robert Tibisar. I graduated from the University of Minnesota Medical School in 2000. I've been a surgeon practicing in Minnesota for 15 years. I oppose this legislation for many reasons, but wish specifically to address Article 1, Section 11 as insufficient safeguard to prevent abuse and denial of coverage by health insurance companies. First, as others have already acknowledged, the health insurance business profits on collecting premiums and limiting payout of benefits. In this model, the insurance corporation is motivated to deny or delay coverage and push doctors and patients to cheaper alternatives. I routinely face this reality in my daily practice. In response to this, we are compelled to contend with insurance companies. This includes navigating the vast bureaucratic network of prior authorization requirements, documentation standards, peer-to-peer appeals, etc. These have now become routine. This process consumes an exorbitant amount of resources. Health insurance companies have huge leverage and advantage in this contest. They create the bureaucracy and invent the stipulations. In my practice, patients are often initially denied coverage that they are legally entitled to. Sure, sometimes we are able to fight and advocate for the patient and overcome this denial through the appeals process, but proper care is always delayed in such cases. Sometimes our patients and staff are slowly worn down by this exhaustive process and completely give up the fight. In regards to end of life, delay in proper care and treatment is critical. Denying or delaying coverage for appropriate treatment or hospice care at the end of life will undoubtedly push patients toward physician-assisted suicide. This is coercive and restricts the freedom of our patients and families to make the best decisions for their health care. I am gravely concerned this bill will significantly limit health care access for everyone in the future. I'm here to stand against this and fight for my patients. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Okay, we're going to move on to member discussion and questions. Discussion to the bill. Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Freiberg. I was hoping you would respond to the testifier from the life insurance industry, in particular, raise some questions about potential underwriting problems with life insurance, the creation of an incentive essentially to buy a life insurance policy once a person has decided to, or perhaps even has requested medical aid in dying medication. And it sure looks to me like the language of the bill opens up the life insurance industry to exactly that kind of a practice. It says that the sale, procurement, or issuance of a life insurance policy or the rate charged shall not be conditioned on or affected by an individual's act of making or rescinding a request for medical aid in dying. So does that provision do what the testifier was concerned about and allow someone who has maybe even already requested medication to then purchase a life insurance policy and the insurer can't even use that as part of the information as to whether to issue the policy or the rate to charge for that policy?
I'm going to give Representative Freiberg a chance to answer that question. I'm also going to ask Robin Rowan to come down to address this as well. So Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Niska. The short answer is no. I'm glad to have the opportunity to refer to that testimony. Ms. Rowan might speak to this further, but this is language specifically requested by the insurance agencies to make it clear that, you know, that they won't get taken advantage of in this way. You know, the generally speaking, insurance companies would presumably not insure a person with a terminal disease, which is the only time they would be eligible to use medical aid in dying. So my understanding is if somebody has a terminal disease and tries to get a life insurance policy, they won't be able to get it. But Ms. Rowan maybe can speak to it further.
Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Niska, I had not planned on testifying on this bill, but I think it's important to make sure the record is clear. We don't view the provisions in this bill as changing our practices at all. If someone, to what Representative Freiberg just said, if someone were to apply for life insurance with a terminal illness with only 6 years to live, we probably wouldn't issue that policy. If they misrepresented that they were ill, we still have the opportunity to avoid the policy for misrepresentation. And we appreciate the clarity in the bill so that we know how to navigate this space. So we don't think this will have an adverse impact on life insurance underwriting, premiums, or anything else.
Any follow-up, Representative Niska?
Not to that point. That's helpful clarity. I think that's important for the legislative record.
Representative O'Driscoll.
I did have other follow-up questions.
Okay. Well, Representative Niska, you can go. When you finished speaking there, I thought you were done. Go ahead, Representative Niska.
I had an additional question about the language on line 1517 and 1518 that says an insurer must not attempt to coerce an individual with a terminal disease to request medical aid in dying medication. And Representative Freiberg, I was just wondering if you could give us some examples of what are the types of things that an insurer might do that would be prohibited by this language. I'm just trying to understand if it has any legal meaning at all.
Chair Freiberg.
Thank you. We had a significant discussion about the aspect of coercion in both the Public Safety and Judiciary Committees. If you look to line, the section starting on line 16.4 of the bill, it lists some examples of what might be considered that, and the penalty is a felony, and I think that would apply whether it's a caregiver, family member, or an insurance company. It just says whoever does any of the following is guilty of a felony, and that can include intentionally altering or falsifying a request for medical aid in dying medication, destroying, mutilating, or concealing the rescission of a request, compelling another individual to request medical aid in dying medication through the use of coercion, undue influence, harassment, duress, compulsion, or other enticement, or compel them to self-administer medical aid in dying through those same things. So it's a term that's defined in the bill.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Freiberg, respectfully, I don't think you're answering my question, which is I understand that nobody is allowed to coerce someone into doing it. My question is about what is the legal effect of this language here that an insurer must not attempt to coerce an individual? What are the types of practices that an insurer might engage in that would trigger this prohibition? Because frankly, I think it's meaningless, and I'm trying to understand if there's any actual legal prohibition, that any actual practice that an insurer could do that's prohibited by this language.
Chair Freiberg.
Well, as we've already discussed, the insurers for example, they say on line 15.12 and 15.3, it says that the insurers cannot deny or alter health care benefits otherwise available to an individual. Like, personally, there's no example of this ever occurring because the law has worked very well in Oregon, where the law has been in effect for 25 years, and it's in 10 other states. I mean, if you want, I pulled up the definition of coerce on Merriam-Webster online. It says to compel to an act or choice, to achieve by force or threat, to restrain or dominate by force. I mean, I don't think insurance companies would ever do that, but we want to be extra clear in the bill that insurance companies can't condition any product they might otherwise provide on whether or not a person used medical aid in dying. They can't compel a person to engage in it, so this language just helps ensure that. But to your point, this has never happened because the law has always worked well in every state where it's in effect.
I'll give you one more follow-up, Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that answer, Representative Freiberg. I would suggest that the reason it's hard to come up with examples of coercion that would cross the line is because the bill already creates a level of coercion, a default state-mandated level of coercion in the provision on page 10, starting in line 10, that where every provider is required in every single conversation that they have with someone who has just received a terminal diagnosis, that they must provide information to that person about the available options, which you in our conversation previously explained does mean that they have to include that the state under this bill has sanctioned them to commit suicide, quote, the alternatives and foreseeable risks and benefits of each. So you're creating a state-mandated guilt trip by every medical provider every time one of the testifiers referred to this as happening. It has to happen 14 different times to a person with a terminal illness. Of course, once you have defined that as the baseline, as something that the state not only permits but requires to happen, then I do think it's understandable that it's hard to identify coercion that goes beyond that legal line that we have already set as the baseline. I would also point out there are I think you're whitewashing a little bit the problems that have happened in other jurisdictions about this. But to the extent that we don't have witnesses talking about coercion, I would point out that the best witness in each one of those potential cases is dead. So this is a bad bill. I hope members vote no.
Chair Freiberg.
Thank you. I would disagree with the characterization that this is coercion. If you read the language you cited on line 10.10, it says a provider must provide sufficient information to an individual with a terminal disease regarding available options, the alternatives, and the foreseeable risks and benefits of each so that the individual is able to make informed decisions regarding the individual's end-of-life health care. It doesn't actually say anything there about medical aid and dying. It just says they have to make they have to provide the patient with all of their available options. That could include palliative care. That could include hospice. I think we want our medical providers telling us what all of the available options are. Just wanted to say that.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do share a lot of the same concerns that Representative Niska made, because I really don't think that there are enforcement mechanisms in place following that section there in Section 11. The point was made during testimony that there are specific instances where it could be, and for us, for our generation of folks, as we're on social media in the future, we could have time after time, day after day, marketing to suggest these points through our own social media. When we consider the impacts that we're talking about in this committee around kids and the things that they see, these same impacts could be seen through social media and otherwise. And I think that this bill lacks the teeth for enforcement there. And so maybe that's an opportunity for you, Representative Freiberg, to continue to work to enhance that language, to provide more safeguards around that. And I would certainly encourage that, especially knowing the importance to this topic across our state. So then beyond that, I just wanted to ask Representative Freiberg, it doesn't appear that this bill requires Medicaid and Minnesota care to cover this sort of coverage. And I just wanted to find out from you what the reason for that was.
Yeah, I'll allow this a little bit. That's getting outside of the scope of our coverage here. We're talking about the private health insurance. That's more of a question for Representative Liebling's committee to look at, but if you can do a brief thing. I don't want to get too far down this road, but Chair Freiberg.
Yeah, there's no mandate for it. I mean,
I think he was asking why you did that, why you didn't mandate it for those public plans.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. At this point, I wasn't really prepared to discuss this provision.
It is not within the scope of the committee, but
at this point, it's an option for people to consider. At some point in the future, we might consider adding it, but that would require an additional legislative discussion. If there's demand for it through those programs, we could do it, but at this point, we're just not including it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Look, I came, you know, today with that question because, you know, if we're going to deal with insurance provisions to this bill, it would be in this committee, and that's why I brought it up, right? You know, if this bill is to move forward and look at this topic, I mean, wouldn't this favor those who are more wealthy, more affluent in our state versus those who are not?
We don't generally cover the public plans in this committee. Those are, so when we hear, for example, the mandate bills, we talk about the impact on the private health insurance market here, and we talk about the impact on the public health insurance market in Chair Liebling's committee. So that's where I was trying to go. Now, I understand that there's sometimes we have a discussion about why here, why not there. That's why I allowed a little bit of latitude, but we're not going to keep going down the path of talking about why the public plans where they are in the context of this. Did you have another subject you'd like to talk about?
Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More some comments, I think, on the nature of what we're looking at here than a question. I think that Section 12 could have been included within the jurisdiction of this committee because it does tie into the other two sections as byproducts of what we were talking about, and that has to do with the death record. The thing that I fear most about our ability to learn about medicine and our ability to be able to garner information and be able to provide suitable research and innovation, medications and things to help people is when we don't let diseases play their natural course out, because we don't know how different diseases can interact with one another. We do not know about whether or not we are going to be able to find cures for that, give us indications of things that we might have missed earlier on that are manifesting themselves later on in the process. So through an artificial means of termination of life, which this bill purports, we tie our own hands in the medical profession by not knowing the final chapter of the story of the book. And to put on a death certificate that the cause of death was the underlying malady or disease doesn't necessarily mean that that was the truth. Someone could have, through the natural course of life, suffocated, had a cardiac arrest, and those were the causes of death. And we lose out on all of those other kinds of research and other kinds of information to be able to help us to make informed medical decisions in treatment of persons as they progress through life if we don't know what the outcomes are because of the artificial termination of death, of life through a death procedure like this. And so what I'm going to encourage members to vote no on this. We need to know as much information as we possibly can for the betterment and health of all persons. And again, we just don't know what the final byproducts are and what people can be preparing themselves for if we administer an artificial form of death prior to natural death. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would have understood if you didn't want me to comment because I know we have to move on here, but I just have to say something about what was just said because, first of all, you know, what goes on death certificates, there's a lot of, that's really, you know, if somebody has a terminal illness and then their heart stops, I don't think that the death certificate is going to say heart attack. You know, so there are different ways these things are done, but the thing that's kind of really bothering me here is the suggestion that we should allow people to suffer in intolerable pain as some kind of science experiment so that we can see how their disease plays out. I just find that so utterly indefensible. I just had to say that. I so disagree with the representative about that. I just find it absolutely terrifying that we would even think about it that way. Thank you.
Brief closing comment from Chair Freiberg.
Sure. Instead of closing remark, I'll just comment on that last point. So because we did meet with the medical examiner yesterday, they reviewed the bill and indicated that the language is workable. So death certificates are a legal document that include a few things. The fact of death, that it occurred, the cause of death, and that's to develop statistics for disease prevention, and the manner of death, and there's four categories that can be included there. It can be natural, it can be suicide, it can be homicide, or it can be accident. Now, other procedures that might be viewed similarly to medical aid in dying are not listed as suicide on death certificates. That can include discontinuing life-sustaining treatment, voluntarily stop eating and drinking, and palliative sedation. You know, just generally speaking, medical aid in dying is not suicide. I know that term gets thrown around a lot. You know, people who die by suicide have a mental disease, and that's just become intolerable for them. People who utilize medical aid in dying are already dying from a terminal disease. And I think that's reflected on this discussion about the medical, on the death certificate. So I'll just leave it there. This is a good bill that protects bodily autonomy. It's consistent with other things we passed. I appreciate the discussion about the insurance provisions, and I hope members will vote yes.
And with that, Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 1930, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion does prevail, and House File 1930, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Members in the, or people in the gallery who were here to observe today, you may, at this point, want to leave. We have several other bills on the agenda. You're welcome to stay, but you're also welcome to leave. If you choose to leave, please do so as quietly as possible. Please save your conversations until you're in the hallway so the committee can continue with its work. Thank you for coming today. The next item on our agenda today is House File 4960 from Representative Tabke. Representative Tabke, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 4960 be laid over for future consideration.
Representative Tabke moves that House File 4960 be laid over, and then you have the A1 amendment, which gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it, I assume?
Yes, sir.
All right. Representative Tabke moves the A1 amendment. Discussion to the A1. Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. Representative Tabke to your bill as amended.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 4960 is another insurance bill building on the Storm Chaser bill that we talked about on the floor a couple days ago and in committee a few weeks ago. And so we have been discussing in Commerce this session about climate change resulting in significantly increased claim activity on insurance. And so in 2022, there was we had a record year of claims, mostly because of major weather events that happened due to climate change. And so in 2022, there was over $6 billion in claims just in Minnesota. And so to help rein in those claims, we're working on different ways where we can help to make sure that the claims aren't out of line with what the issues are. And so this bill here today moves from a straight dollar deductible to a deductible can be based on the value of the loss. So it would be a percentage-based option for folks. It doesn't require that it be a percentage, but it is a potential percentage base. And so a policyholder will have some skin in the game then at claim time when it comes to determine which contractor they want to do work with. And so this bill does not mandate the companies move to this type of product. It merely allows it to happen within Minnesota law. And so, Mr. Chair, we have Mr. Cocking here to further discuss the bill.
Mr. Cocking.
Chair Stevenson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Aaron Cocking. I'm the president and CEO of the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, the nonprofit trade association representing the property casualty companies doing business in Minnesota. And let me start by thanking Representative Tabke for his willingness to chief author this bill and for his interest in working to bring insurance costs down. This bill, as amended, makes changes to allow for insurer innovation and removes and updates unnecessary hurdles that impede insurer's ability to accurately match price to risk. Section 1, as amended, allows for an insurance company to offer a policy with a deductible that is a percentage of the value of the loss. Many insurers have moved to a percentage-based deductibles, but they are based on the overall value of the dwelling. Allowing this change will encourage policyholders to have more skin in the game at claim time. Now, let me give you an example of how this would work. Contractor A tells a homeowner that they will replace their damaged roof for $30,000. Contractor B tells a homeowner that they will replace their damaged roof for $50,000. With a flat dollar deductible of $1,500, the insured is out the same amount regardless of which contractor they choose. The insurance company pays contractor A $28,500 and contractor B $48,500. If the policyholder had a 7% value of the loss deductible, they would owe contractor A $2,100 and contractor B $3,500. The insurer would then owe $27,900 and $46,500 respectively. Each contractor is still an option to the policyholder, but they pay $1,400 more for choosing the more expensive option. We believe that putting some additional responsibility on policyholders to select contractors who aren't ripping them off and insurers off is a good public policy priority. Section 2 and 3 help address the issues of multiple weather-related losses. Minnesota is the only state that prohibits insurers from taking into account previous weather losses. As Minnesota faces additional storm and loss activity due to the climate crisis, identifying the areas that are more prone to loss should be a factor insurers can consider. And we're working to clarify Section 3 as well. I spoke with Mr. Peter Brickwitty from the Department of Commerce on Friday, and he pointed out some potential questions the Department of Commerce had on this language, namely their belief that insurers should already be able to do this. Finally, on the language added in the amendment dealing with the zip codes, we are trying to clarify language the way it had been interpreted for more than two decades. When this language originally passed, discussion in committee centered on the application of this to Minneapolis and St. Paul. The effect of reading this to apply statewide is that we will end up with a single rating territory. That's because the fact that zip codes do not fit perfectly within municipal boundaries. By taking this to its logical endpoint, because of all of the overlaps of zip codes into multiple municipalities, we arrive at a single rating territory for all of Minnesota. This is a huge problem because weather exposures in southwest Minnesota look nothing like they do in the Twin Cities or in northeast Minnesota. This is a much needed fix. Now, I know the department's not supportive of this language, and we are working with them to come to a resolution. We wanted to add this to the bill in the event it ends up in the omnibus, so we have a placeholder to keep this alive. Chair Stevenson, thank you to you and to this committee and the interest that you have shown in trying to address insurance cost issues this session. We believe this bill is a good step in helping to further that objective, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We also have Mr. Brickwitty. Sign up to testify on this. Mr. Brickwitty, if you want to come down and offer your testimony at this time.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Assistant Commissioner at the Commerce Department. Appreciate Representative Tapke bringing the bill forward. As Mr. Cocking noted, I think this is still a bit of a work in progress, but we remain committed to working it through. Three items that I just want to flag that we're continuing to work on. Mr. Cocking kind of touched on this a little bit. We're, I think, genuinely still trying to figure out what Section 3 of the bill does, and there may be a drafting error, so we'll work through that. We really like the first section of the amendment that Representative Tapke put on. We think that is a strong improvement. I will note, I think we still have some concerns about the cities of the first class section, but we'll continue to work through those. That's a new concept that wasn't included in the underlying bill, and that's the one that we're probably furthest away on at present. But as is the case and many things during deadline week, we continue to work and hope to have peace in the valley at some point for the committee. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer questions.
And we appreciate the work you're doing, and that's why we're laying the bill over today to allow for those continued conversations to try and resolve the outstanding issues. So thank you. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Member discussion to the bill. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the Insurance Federation, which is what do we have to tell us that these reforms would result in either holding down or reducing premiums?
Mr. Cocking.
Chair Stevenson, Representative Liebling, great question. I think one that's fair for any time we have these bills that come before. That's the first question I get from a lot of folks is, you've got these changes, what's it gonna do to my premium? My argument would be that on all of these changes, the less that, the more that we accurately match people's risk to the price that they pay is an important part of this. And so from our standpoint, on specifically as it relates to, for example, the weather-related losses, people who have more weather-related losses, and once you file a claim, your likelihood of filing your second claim, third claim, fourth claim, kind of ramps up like this. That's a consideration because as a result, people who don't file claims are arguably paying more than they should be. And so by being able to accurately match these prices to risk, your constituents who are not paying, who are not suffering multiple losses, are able to save on that standpoint.
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you. And thanks for that. But, you know, maybe color me skeptical, but, you know, that's maybe how it should work. But, you know, we don't set insurance rates in the state, as far as I know. And, you know, what I'm kind of asking for is how is the industry going to assure us that, in fact, holding down the industry's costs will, in fact, translate to the consumer, holding down some costs for the consumer? That was kind of my question. Maybe you really can't answer that, but that's kind of where I'm going. Thank you.
And maybe we can add to that. You can talk a little bit about the
the process by which the department approves your rates and forms and things like that. But did you want, is okay if Mr. Cocking takes that first? I saw you. Okay.
Sure.
Mr. Cocking.
Did you want
to
go for it? Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, I think that, I've been in front of this committee a lot this year and last year, even talking about the impact of these additional storms and what we're paying out as a result of the changing climate. And so are people going to see a real dollar reduction in the amount that they pay for premium? I think that that's unlikely based on what we're seeing on claims. I think the hope of what we want to see is that we're reducing the claims in such a fashion that that premiums aren't going up as much or as rapidly as they can. And again, I kind of talk about matching that price to that risk, that if you live in an area where you're constantly hammered with storms, arguably you should be paying for that, so that somebody who lives in an area that it never hails and never storms to the extent that that exists in Minnesota isn't kind of making up for that.
Representative Tabke, you had something you wanted to add there.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Stevenson and Representative Liebling. So with this, over the weekend, I was talking to a homeowners association that had a 400% increase in their homeowners insurance and that kind of thing. And the way I explained the work that we're doing this session in the world of insurance is I don't have any delusional expectations it's going to like reduce insurance costs because like we talked about earlier in this session is that there are tremendous climate impact changes that are happening that are being felt first and foremost by the insurance world and how that works. And so this is a little piece of a really large puzzle that we can put into place to help at least push down those inflators on things, as well as there's a significant amount of work that is done by the department to make sure that what they are charging is actually representative of what the needs are in the real world with underwriting and things like that. So it's there are pieces there, and this is one of them.
Representative Katisa Watun.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Tabke, for continuing these conversations. So just in quick succession to your mention of the Homeowners Association that you were speaking with this weekend, I'm working with several of my constituents who are dealing with a similar issue. But in previous conversations with Mr. Cocking about this, it's my understanding that there are people who live in a homeowners association. The Homeowners Association itself has a commercial-type property insurance, but then individual homeowners have a separate policy for their individual dwelling. How does this language, this only impacts the individual homeowners policies that people who reside within a homeowners association would contribute to? Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Katisa Watum, I think that's correct. Because I think largely of the deductibles that we have in mind and the impact for the losses that for the homeowners, especially the stuff we're talking about is weather related losses, which is largely on the exterior. And so the commercial policy that sits kind of on the structure, if you will, wouldn't be subject to this in the same way that a homeowner's policy, if you kind of follow where I'm, maybe that makes sense.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for that. And I know, we will continue to explore what these homeowners association residents are dealing with. I know multiple insurance companies have left the market. There might be other organizations who are working with the Commerce Department to come into the state and offer those same policies that we're kind of seeing dwindling of options amongst our Minnesota residents here. So I think that this is a good step in the right direction.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cocking, I think it's an interesting idea, and I had even offered some suggestions too when we were talking about this bill, about the way that deductibles may be companioned in here. There may be a flat dollar amount for a complete loss, or there may be percentage losses for things. So that is a way that premiums can be affected by perhaps some premium savings by kind of parsing down a little bit and not one deductible fits all. Just for clarification, this would apply in a homeowner's policy. Like an HO3 or an HO5 or even to an HO6 for Parts A and Part B coverage, correct? Dwelling and other structures?
Mr. Cocking.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, I think that's correct.
And
Representative Driscoll.
And then Part C is your personal property. That's not what's being covered in this particular or anticipated in this conversation. Is that correct?
Mr. Cocking.
I think that's, Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, I think that's correct. I think to your point about how we bifurcate the deductibles would maybe play into that as well, on whether or not you have a wind hail deductible that someone offers the percentage deductible at, and if they're on a flat dollar deductible for whether, as we talked about, a total loss, or whether you're talking about personal property or something outside of what we would generally expect to see as the result of storm activity, I think is probably fair.
Representative Driscoll.
Just final comment. I think that there's a real possibility to reinvent the way that we do deductibles that can have an impact that preserves the industry's ability to offer affordable products and consumers to be able to have options and choices in which to choose their deductible.
All right. Representative Tabke, if you have a brief closing comment, make it now.
No, Mr. Chair, I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. And with that, the bill is laid over. The next bill on the agenda, and I guess before I pick up the bill, I'll just say that we have 15 minutes left in this hearing and four bills. I think we should be okay, but I just want members to kind of be tracking the time there. The next bill on our agenda is House File 4348 from Representative Freiberg. And when you are situated, if you want to make a motion.
Sure, I'll move that House File 4348 be referred to Judiciary, I believe.
That's right. Representative Freiberg moves House File 4348 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. You have the A1 amendment, which gets the bill in the shape you'd like us to consider as, correct?
Yes, I will move the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment is moved. Any discussion to the A1? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Representative Freiberg to your bill as amended.
Thank you. This is a Conference of State Bank Supervisors Model Data Security Law. So the language of the model has already been worked out between the industry and the 50 states financial regulators before being approved. And on the Minnesota side, it's been shared out with the Minnesota mortgage industry and other Minnesota organizations. And to my knowledge, there's been no pushback. I think in recognition for your time, I'll maybe just turn it over to my testifier at this point.
And your testifier is John Kelly. Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Chair and members. For the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. I just would echo this. This is a good bill. This basically brings the state, we're trying to have as much alignment as possible with the Federal Trade Commission safeguards rule in Gramm-Leach-Briley so that the rules are the same for both our non-depository and our depository institutions. This is going to be able to protect Minnesota consumers' data and allow us to respond to events and allow us to look at data in our examinations of non-depository institutions. We think it's a good bill.
All right. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative Driscoll.
A former member of this committee, Representative Davis, would be impressed that I asked this question. There's no continuing education requirements that are found in this bill, are there? And yeah, I've been around here for a while to find the humor in that bill, but I digress. Withdraw my question.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, any closing comments, Chair Freiberg?
It's a good bill. Please support it.
All right. Representative Freiberg renews his motion that House File 4348 as amended be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. And House File 4348 as amended is recommended be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. The next bill on our agenda today is House File 4034 from Representative Cha. Representative Cha, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would. No.
Representative Cha moves that House File 4034 be referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. And you have the A2 amendment. Would you like to offer the A2?
I'd like to offer the A2 amendment to put the bill into order. Thank you.
All right. Representative Cha moves the A2 amendment. Any discussion to the A2 amendment? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. A2 is adopted. Representative Cha, to your bill as amended.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce HF 4034. A bipartisan bill in regards to legislation to establish consumer protection in residential real estate transaction in the state of Minnesota. This bill proposes amendments to existing statute and introduces new provisions to regulate service agreements by defining unfair service agreements and prohibiting certain practices as long-term and binding agreements. The bill seeks to safeguard the rights and the interests of the consumers. One, it standardizes the coordination of benefits for payments and loss assessment in condominium or townhomes. Two, it prevents excessive long-term abusive real estate service agreements, an example, a 40-year listing contract. And three, it removes an exemption for out-of-state debt collection. And I'd like to, turn this over to my testifier, John.
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Chair. Again, for the record, John Kelly, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce. This consumer protection bill, as Representative Cha mentioned, we're trying to standardize the trigger event for folks who have coverage in condominium and townhome insurance policies. We're close We're working out a few more provisions in this section with the independent insurance agents and IFM and other stakeholders, CAI, and we think we'll have it settled by the time it comes back for markup. But we think it's a good thing. Some Minnesotans, even though they've had insurance the entire time in their condo, they've changed carriers from one to another, and their policies right now can have a different set of triggering events, even though all the other coverages are the same, and they can have an assessment and they'll have no coverage. So we're trying to prevent that and just make it standard so folks who've had coverage the entire time aren't having to pay for this out of pocket. This came directly from our Consumer Services Center folks who have seen this a lot. We think we're going to get it right. We're very close. We appreciate the efforts of the insurance industry here in Minnesota working with us on this important bill, as well as CAI and others, realtors. The second provision, as Representative Cha mentioned, it's preventing really abusive practice for seniors and vulnerable adults where they'll be offered $500 to $1,000, and they'll have the exclusive listing rights on a home, and they're also will file those listing rights as liens on the property, and we want to prevent this practice. Minnesota would be the 20th state to prevent this if this passes. And finally, we're removing the current licensing exemption for non-resident debt collection companies and replacing that language with language that would allow the commissioner to do that, waive those requirements by order. This is something that we do on the real estate side. We have that written with the states for seven states, and we'd like to do the same for debt collectors. We're just seeing abusive practices, and it's also a lot of staff time and work to determine if that state has, if we have reciprocity or not in terms of the requirements, and we think this is a good consumer protection bill focusing on these three areas, and we'd appreciate the committee's support.
All right. Are there any members of the public wishing to testify as to this? Oh, I apologize. There were people who signed up in advance. First, we have Mr. Cocking.
Chair Stevenson, once again, for the record, Aaron Cocking with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota. We are well aware of the issue that Representative Chaw is trying to fix in Section 2 of his bill, and we agree in concept with what the department is trying to accomplish. Our concerns are with the current language and are working with the department to make sure that whatever we do is workable from an insurance standpoint. What we have seen or heard from other states is that without a proper definition of loss or assessed loss, things much broader than what insurance is intended to cover can be assessed by an association and then paid or asked to be paid by an insurer. So we're working to make sure that losses paid under this change are truly what a typical insurance policy would cover. We're happy to continue working with the DOC to come to an agreement that achieves what we all want, and I'm happy to answer questions.
All right, and next we have Paul Eager. Come forward, state your name for the record, proceed to your testimony, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Paul Eger. I'm Senior Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Realtors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you, Representative Cha and the Department of Commerce for bringing this bill forward. We support the legislation, encourage your support for it as well. I am hearing a lot more from our members about this loss assessment issue and the gap that buyers are finding in the coverage when they purchase a property in an association, and there may have been a hail event or something of that sort, and so this bill would hopefully address that situation moving forward. We also do support addressing the provision, which is now Section 4 in the bill as amended, to deal with these 40-year so-called exclusive listing agreement contracts that are being recorded on also on the land records. For those of you that have been around for a while, this is eerily reminiscent of the property assessed clean energy loan issues that you all addressed in statute on a bipartisan basis in 2017 and 2018 with some additional consumer protection. So we support your efforts in this area as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Now, are there any members of the public who wish to testify on the bill? Seeing none, member discussion to the bill. Representative Farr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Chaw. So definitely appreciate the Section 4 of this bill, and I am not sure if I am quite a co-author yet, but I will be. So
you are.
In process. Just starting to see more and more of that unfair service agreement out there, and so I think that's a really great portion of this bill, and so I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I'm in support. Thank you.
Representative Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I tend to generally agree with everywhere we're going on here. The only question and concern that I have is, given the amount of testimony and bills that we've heard about homeowners associations and the issues associated with that, and now loss assessments on here, I would like to hold off and support on this bill until such time that we see what that resolution and language is to clean that part of the legislation up. Very quick question to Mr. Kelly, if I might. Are you anticipating, Mr. Kelly, that the bill, when the amendment or the fix when it comes back, will offer a standard set of triggers that would be required in all policies that offer this commercial coverage for the loss assessment? Or where's our sticking point? Where are we at? If you can just kind of summarize it in 25 words or less, maybe.
Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Chair and Ranking Member O'Driscoll. So, yes, the idea with this would be that all policies would have the same trigger event once this law passed. Right now, there's different trigger events, date of assessment versus date of loss. And so that would just make all policies have the same trigger event.
Representative Driscoll.
So then all policy forms would then be updated to change the language of what's the trigger, so we'd have standardization. So when an association is comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges.
Mr. Kelly.
That is correct.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Any closing comments, Representative Shaw?
Yes. No, I just want to thank Representative Farr for having the discussion and reaching out to me, and please support the bill. Thank you.
All right. Representative Shaw renews his motion that House File 4034, as amended, be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. And House File 4034, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. The next bill on our agenda is House File 3330, I guess. I move House File 3330 be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. I will also move the A1 amendment, which I assume gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it.
Yes, please.
All right. Any discussion to the A1? Seeing no discussion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A1 is adopted. Representative Hemmingson-Yeager, to your bill as amended.
Great. Thank you so much. It is with deep and heartfelt gratitude for your attention and hearing this bill today. Imagine if your kid, your grandkid, your niece, or your nephew was hospitalized for a genetic disorder. It can take up to 7 specialists, sometimes over 5 years, misdiagnoses, just to get an answer of what's going on. In that time, how many more hospitalizations and attempted treatments have also occurred, and how costly is that to get these answers and treatments? Now, imagine how different things could be if your insurance covered rapid whole genome sequencing. You would get an answer within 2 weeks. You could start treatments earlier, interventions earlier, and everything sooner. You could avoid future health care costs. House File 3330 does just that. It mandates insurance to cover rapid whole genome sequencing. This is already available in public programs and in some other commercial insurance products. This is bipartisan, and I want to thank Representative Torkelson for his conversations in developing this bill. It is intentionally narrow to provide the most help to our most vulnerable kids. And I think that is seen in the Commerce Report that it could be as low as 2 cents per member per month. Because of the technology, guardrails are already intact. Because it is a whole genome sequencing, the genetic code of the underlying ailment is not going to change. Therefore, providers ordering tests would order a test just as any other test they would order. And the need for ordering additional tests is not necessary because it would provide no further information. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you again for your attention.
All right. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing no discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3330, as amended, be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 3330, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. The final bill on our agenda today is House File 4557 from Chair Cleavorn. Chair Cleavorn, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you. I would like to move House File 4557 to be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy.
Chair Cleavorn moves House File 4557 be re-referred to Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And you also have the A3 amendment, which I assume gets the bill in the shape you'd like the committee to consider it.
It does, and I'd like to thank Lito Driscoll for his cooperation in this A3 amendment.
All right. So Chair Cleavorn moves the A3 amendment. The chair also seconds the thanks to Representative O'Driscoll. Any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. A3 is adopted. Chair Cleaborn, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The CMS has issued additional guidance in 2023 that shows that benefits designed to restrict coverage on the basis of health conditions are presumptively discriminatory. And this bill is about hair prostheses. And so if we adopt this bill, the benefits will align and we will be in more compliance with the CMS guidelines and less likely to be ruled as discriminatory. So I ask that our members support this bill for cancer patients who are suffering from a medical condition that causes them to lose their hair, and that would help them to be able to receive a prosthesis.
All right. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing no discussion, I will renew the motion that Chair Cleaborn renews her motion that House File 4557, as amended, be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 4557, as amended, is recommended be re-referred to the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. And that concludes our agenda for today, so the meeting is adjourned.